This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
There are two dinim in the Sedra that we're going to talk about tonight, and the interrelationship with one another. In fact, as I was preparing the shiur, the subject started getting so big that I might even land up giving three shiurim. That's tonight and next week and the following week, all on this one concept. Firstly, we're told in Shmot, chapter 23, verse 7, Kaf Gimel Zayin, Midvar Sheker Tirchok. Distance yourself from Sheker, from anything untrue, anything which is a lie. That's the first din that we're looking at. And the second din is V'shochad lo tikach, and you shall not take bribery, ki ha-shochad ye'aver pikchim, because bribery blinds wise people, V'salef divrei tzadikim, and it causes the words of righteous people to become distorted. So two isurim we're looking at. The one isur, or the one chiyuv, is to distance oneself from anything dishonest, and the other is shochad. One isn't permitted to take bribery. The whole question of honesty and dishonesty is a complex one. You know, there was a Rav, and a congregant came to see him, and he said, Rabbi, I've got a major moral problem which you need to help me sort out. What's the problem? He says, well, you know my business. I sell machinery. And I sold a machine to a certain individual, and he sent me the money for the machine, but he sent me 5,000 rand too much. And you know, Chaim and I are in partnership, and now it's a shaila what to do. So the Rav said, so your question is whether you have to give back the 5,000 rand or not, surely. He said, no, that's no shaila. I'm not asking that. Do I tell Chaim about it? Each person on their own level has different moral problems when it comes to sheker. Each person finds the line drawn down honesty a difficult line. We've talked often on the one hand that one has to be careful not to make a shlemiel of oneself. One doesn't have to go and give things away for honesty if it's not really expected of one. On the other hand, there is such a concept as being meticulously careful that every word that comes out of one's mouth should be correct. And it's not just words that come out of one's mouth. That's why this shiur is probably going to take 3 weeks. It's one's behavior. It's one's beliefs. It's one's thinking system. It's one's system of values. This midvar sheker tirchak, in other words, distancing oneself from things which are unreal, things which are untrue, is a chiyuv which envelops every aspect of human existence and the total human personality. It's not just talking. How far does the Torah go in requiring a removal from things dishonest? How far? What is the limits? Do you have to give the 5,000 rand back? If you don't, do you have to tell Chaime? And so, how far do we go? So I'll show you how far we go. Bring you three different Gemaras. Each one is a different type of honesty or dishonesty from the other. Apropos of our shiur this afternoon, where we discussed that a wife is designed to be the most wonderful companion if a husband knows how to handle her, and the most miserable human being to have anything to do with if he doesn't know how to handle her. That's what the wife is very extreme, and she has to be, and the essence is in the handling, how she's handled. She, by nature, she responds extremely positively to the correct handling and extremely destructively and negatively to the into incorrect handling. So much so that the Gemara says here, "Motzi ani mar mimoves es aisha." There's a pasuk from Kohelet, which the Gemara is discussing here, which says, "I find a woman more bitter than death." Right? The same author says elsewhere, "Motzo isha, motzo tov," that if you find a wife, you found goodness. Depends how you handle her. Sometimes one finds a wife and motzo isha, motzo tov, there's nothing better than that. And sometimes, "Motzi ani mar mimoves es aisha," I find a wife as bitter as death. And in case you think that's meant to be taken allegorically, the Gemara tells a story. Rav, havako metzara lo devisu. Rav used to have trouble with his wife. It wasn't only nowadays, even great people have had marital problems. And the Gemara brings a few similar sort of stories where they had various marital problems, but this was Rav, the great Rav. His wife used to make his life a misery. Ki omala vidili tlufchi, if he used to say, "Give me please some pea soup," avdale chimtzi, she used to make beetroot soup. Chimtzi, so he would try and say, "Give me some beetroot soup," avdale tlufchi. Always the opposite. What he didn't like, she would give him. Ki godal chia berei, when chia barav grew up, he thought he's going to be the peacemaker here. Apichlo. He said to his father, "Look, you tell me what you want my mother to make you, and I'll organize it." So if his father asked for pea soup or for bean soup, then he went to his mother and he says, "Father wants beetroot soup," and his mother made bean soup, and that was just what his father wanted. And so he organized it to make sure that by telling a little untruth, his father would get what he wanted, and his mother would have the nachas of giving him the opposite of what he wanted, and everybody would be happy. Amale. So he said, the Rav said to Chia, "You know, your mother is really improving. I don't know what's happened recently, but things seem to be getting better." Said Chia, "Really, I'm the one who's organizing here. I'm turning around what you say." He said to him, "That's what people say, that those who come out of you, your children, in other words, sometimes teach you chokhmas which you should know yourself. At lo tavid hachi. But you must stop doing it. Shenema limdu l'shoinam daver sheker." Because there's a pasuk from Yirmiyah where it talks about people who get used to telling lies. So you mustn't do this anymore. Says Rashi, "Pa'amim shehaben machkim es aviv." Sometimes a child teaches the father wisdom. Ani hoyo lilasos ken. I'm the one who should have done so all along. So what Chia is saying is, what Rav is saying is, okay, from now on I'll ask for the opposite, but you don't tell any more lies. You're not allowed to do it. It's a strange Gemara. Shalom, darke shalom, for peace is one of the things which you are allowed to tell a lie for. And Rav stops his son in this case telling a lie. Why? Probably because Rav feels that we can manage without it. I think there are two things. Number one, he's worried about the continuity of it, the continuousness of it. Every day, he is going to have to be telling a lie. When are you allowed to tell a lie for peace? You're going to tell a lie. You're allowed to say that a color is very beautiful. If you're at a wedding and there's an ugly color, you can tell the chosan how beautiful you think she is. It's a lie, but you're allowed to do it. You know, because you do it once or twice, that's it. It's for good reason. And we'll discuss this still in a future shiur on the subject, exactly when you can tell a lie and when you can't tell a lie, but that's one of the cases that you can. There's a case with the brothers of Yosef, where after Yaakov died, the brothers said to Yosef, "Your father instructed us to tell you that you mustn't harm us, you mustn't take any revenge on us." Says Rashi over there, what do you mean? The father never suspected that Yosef would take revenge. It's not the kind of thing the father would have said. So the brothers were telling a lie. But they're allowed to tell a lie for shalom, for peace. So for shalom you're allowed to tell a lie, why not here? So the one is because of the continuousness of it. Every single day this child is going to have to be telling a lie. And that's why he brings the posuk, he doesn't bring our posuk from the Sedra, "Midvar sheker tirchak," distance yourself from telling a lie. He brings the posuk of "Limdu l'shoinam daber sheker." of people who are learning, who are getting used to, who are educating themselves in talking untruthfully. That's what he doesn't like about it. And number two, we can manage without it. Because without the son, now that the father knows the trick, he can do it himself, and then it's not a lie at all. Because if the father does it, it's very simple. What's happening here with all these wires? Huh? If the father says, please give me pea soup, that's not a lie. He's asked for pea soup. The fact that really he wants something else, okay. And then the wife gives him bean soup, that's also okay. So the father can manage the whole thing without anybody having to tell a lie. Therefore, there's no heter for the son to tell a lie. But you see how far it goes. That even to bring about peace between father and mother, even though he's really organizing, the truth comes out. The father really wants bean soup. And he's only telling the lie in order that the father should get what he wants. So it's like another way of saying bean soup. In his mother's language, bean soup is beetroot soup. So he says beetroot soup. Even that, Rav doesn't want his son Chia doing. Even that he considers is not right. That's one Gemara. That's it. Yevomus Daf Samach Gimel Amud Aleph 63a. Another one, Cecil, where are you? Sorry to be bringing this Gemara. I know you don't like it and you're troubled by it, and I'm not even going to ease your cause for trouble. I'm bringing it just for an illustration. It's a Gemara which I've brought before. Ha'u mirabonan, there was a certain Rav, v'Rav Tavus Shemayin, his name was Rav Tavus, v'Amri lo Rav Tivyumi Shemayin, some say his name was Rav Tivyumi. De'ihavu yahavile kol chalali di alma. If you would give this man everything in the whole world, if you would give him the whole world, it's all his. Loi have a mashani bedibure. He wouldn't, not tell a lie. The Gemara doesn't even use the word tell a lie. Mashani bedibure, say something inaccurate. He wouldn't utter a word which is not 100% accurate. That was Rav Tivyumi. Have you ever heard of Rav Tivyumi before? Nor had I before I heard the Gemara. Rav Tivyumi. Just one of the many. He wasn't even... wasn't a Rabbi Akiva or a Rabbi Meir or a Rav or a Chia. Not even one of the well-known ones. This was an ordinary man in those days. If you gave him everything in the whole world, loy mashani bedibure, he wouldn't utter something which is inaccurate. Ikloy laho atra v'kushta shumei. He came to a certain place where the name of the place was Kushta, truth. Sounded a nice place, but loy havu mashani bedibureyu. And he felt very comfortable in this particular town, because nobody in that whole town would say anything that was inaccurate. Can you imagine such a town? Not the men, not the women, not the children, not the servants. Nobody in that whole town would utter a word which is not accurate. So that was just the ideal place for him to live. And not only that, below have a mayis inish mehosam below in the zimne. And nobody died from that place before their time. Everybody lived to a good old age, and everybody was... just didn't happen that anybody died early. That was where he was going to take a wife from. For a man who's so meticulously honest, to have a wife who isn't would be moitza anisha mami movis. It would be worse than death for him to have such a situation. A man who's that meticulously straight and meticulously honest can't live with a woman who doesn't appreciate and also subscribe to the same standards of honesty. Vahavuli tartin benin, and they had two sons. Mina from this. He had two sons from this woman. Yom Echad, one day, have a yasve dvisu v'kochayfe resha. One day, his wife was busy washing her hair. Ato yishivavto, a neighbor came, torfo adasha, and knocked on the door. Sova lav urach ara, so he thought to himself, this isn't nice, she's going to say, is your wife here? What must I say? She's washing her hair. It's none of her business what my wife is doing. It's not derech eretz to go and say that your wife is doing something intimate, she's having a bath. It's not a nice thing to say. It's got nothing to do with anybody. Omar la, so he said to the neighbor, Lesa hacha, sorry, she's not here at the moment. Shchivule taltin benin, his two children died. Atu inshi de atra lekame, the people of the town came before him. Omrule, they said, my hai, what's going on? People don't die young here. Children don't die in this town. What have you done? Amalu hachi ave maisa, he told them the story. He said, I said she wasn't here just because she was unavailable. So the Amrule, they said to him, "Bimtuta minach pok mi atri, loy tagari behu motna bahanachinshi. Leave our town and don't bring death into our place." That's it. And I think I told you last week or the week before, there's some suburbs, religious Jewish suburbs, where they make you sign what school you'll send their children, your children. And there's some religious suburbs where they make you sign that you won't have a television in your house. And there are all sorts of funny places. In this place, they made you sign that you'll be honest, that you'll never tell a lie. That was the most important thing. Much more important than if you've got a television or not, or if you send your children to this school or to that school, or if you wear a big black hat or a small black hat or a long black coat or a short black coat, or whether your beard is 6 inches long or 9 inches long. Much more important than all that was that you loy mashani b'diburayu. In that town, nobody tells a lie. And they considered this a lie. To say your wife's not home when she is home, that's a lie. And that they couldn't tolerate in their society. A little town called Kushta, we've never even heard of it. We've heard of London. We've heard of New York. We've heard of Paris. We've heard Lahavdil of Yerushalayim, Tel Aviv, Johannesburg. None of these towns are a little anything to Kushta. Can you imagine a town where nobody told a lie? Nothing. Absolutely no. Not something which was even on the verge of possibly being a lie. And so meticulous were they that to say that my wife isn't home when she really is, even though you have good reason to say so, is considered such an offense against the basis of their society that even the Ribbono Shel Olam feels that this can't be tolerated. And this principle that nobody dies young there had to be broken, and this man suffered the death of the two youngest members of his family so that it should be clear to everybody, including himself, that it's in that he's been misbehaving. That's the area where he's been inaccurate. That's how far the Torah goes in matters of honesty. And I'll show you one other. Sorry, that one, I think I told you where it was. Sanhedrin, Daf Tzadi Zayin Amud Aleph, 97a. And the third one is in Makos, Kaf Dalet Amud Aleph, 24a. Where the Gemara just says on the posuk, V'dover emes bilvovoi, a person who speaks, normally this is translated as a person who speaks truth in his heart. But the Gemara translates it more as V'dover emes bilvovoi, he who speaks the truth that is in his heart. Says the Gemara, who's an example of that? V'dover emes bilvovoi, kegoin Rav Safra. Rav Safra is a good example of a man who is dover emes bilvovoi. What's the story with Rav Safra? Rashi brings the story from the She'iltas. B'She'iltas de Rav Achai, says Rashi, B'hachi havi uvde de Rav Safra. This was the story of Rav Safra. Hoyoloi chefetz echod limkor. He had a certain object which he was advertising for sale. Uvo odom echod lefonov b'sho she'aya korei kriyashma. Rav Safra was busy reading kriyashma, and the man came to make an offer for the object. The Omar Loin, he said to Rav Safra, while Rav Safra was saying Kriyashma, Ten li achefetz bekach, bekach domim. Give me the object for so and so much money. The Loi anohu mipnei shayakore Kriyashma. And he couldn't answer him because he was busy reading Kriyashma. This means one of two things. Either in those days they used to read Kriyashma quite softly, because if he was shouting Kriya Shema, the man would have seen that he was reading Kriya Shema. Or it means that this man was either a non-Jew, didn't understand what the Jew was doing, or a complete Amoritz. Kasovu zeh sheloi ayarotze litnoi bedamim halalu. So the buyer thought that Rav Safra obviously isn't happy with the money, because he didn't even hear. He wants to sell his object. The man comes and makes an offer, 1,000 rand. And he just carries on. So he thinks obviously 1,000 rand isn't impressing him. For Hosef, Amal Tanali Bekach Yosef. He said 2,000 rand. And so he went on, up and up and up. La'acha shesiyim kriyashma. When he finished, Adoshem Elokechem Emes. Amal Loi, Rav Safra said to this man, as I say, couldn't have been a colleague of Rav Safra exactly. Toil hachefetz, you can have the object. Bedamim she'amalta barishoina. The figure you first mentioned when you started, the first 1,000 rand, although you're now offering me 20,000 rand, you can take it for 1,000 rand. Sheba'oisan domim hayodati litnamlach. Because when I heard out of the corner of my ear that you were offering me 1,000 rand, in my mind I said, fine, that's good enough for me. And you only went on carried on because you didn't know that I had already accepted your first offer. But I had already accepted it, so take it for 1,000 rand. That's what it is. I don't think that legally, even our pi halacha, Rav Safra had committed himself. Nevertheless, these are the standards one sees up till where one's meant to strive. It's not considered, that's not considered making a shlumiel of yourself. Man offers you 1,000 rand and you simply don't have the opportunity to accept it. And he carries on, he adds more, not because you're not prepared to accept 1,000 rand, but because he misunderstands you and doesn't realize that you're prepared to accept. So he ups it further and further. Says Rav Safra, emotionally I'd already sold it to you. The Dover MS Bilvovoy, a man who speaks the truth which is in his heart. In my heart I'd sold it to you, so out comes from what's in my heart, and I've got to sell it to you for the initial amount. How does one reach these levels of yashrus, of being so straight and of being so honest? All these are cases, at least two of them, are cases where there's some financial gain involved. But Rabbeinu Yonah in Shaar HaShlishi of the Shaarei Tshuva in Kuf Pei Vav, I think it is, paragraph 186, he says, no, sorry, 181, Kuf Pei Aleph, he says, divides liars into 9 categories. There are 9 types of liars. We'll go through them all, as I say, if I give 3 shiurim on this subject, which I am planning to do, we'll go through the Rabbeinu Yonah inside, probably. And one of the categories of liars, he says, is a man who lies without any financial gain at all. Just a little, he exaggerates. You say to him, I don't know, how many people were there at the football yesterday? This is 1,000, 2,000, 10,000, when there were really only 500. He gets nothing out of it. Just exaggerates, gives an inaccurate figure. He says silly little things which are dishonest, or which are not true, but they don't hurt anybody, and he doesn't gain from it at all. In our moral training, we wouldn't see anything wrong with it. What I'm saying really is that when we talk about honesty, we're talking about crookery, but not about honesty. In other words, if somebody gives us change, let's say, gives us 10 rand when he should have given us 9 rand, and he says, sorry, how much did I give you? And you count and you see it's 10 rand. And now the question is, do I say 9 rand, and then I've got an extra rand, or do I say 10 rand? I said, no, I've got to be honest. I can't tell a lie. You gave me 10 rand, here's 1 rand back. But why don't I tell the lie in that situation? Normally we think, why? Because it's a lie. I'm not allowed to tell a lie. No, that's not the reason you're not telling the lie. The reason you're not telling the lie is because you don't want to steal the rand. But where it comes to telling lies where nobody is hurt and you have no advantage, it's just not accurate, that's all. It's not what really happened. But it makes no difference to anybody. Then I would say to myself, that's not so serious. And we do that kind of thing all the time. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, although on the one hand, it's correct to say that such a liar is less severe because he doesn't cause anybody any financial loss. So from the aspects of crookery, he's less of a liar. From the aspects of lying, he's the biggest liar that there can possibly be. And he gets the worst punishment that there can possibly be for lying. Because a man who lies for money is not a liar. He's a thief. A man who lies without money is a liar through and through. Why are you telling a lie? What do you get out of it? You're not doing anybody in and you're not gaining anything. So why do you tell a lie? Just because it's not important to you to be accurate. That's a liar. That's the real classical liar. The man who we, with our moral training, would think is not really a liar at all, says Rabbeinu Yonah, he's the biggest liar of them all. Because he has no ulterior motive to tell a lie. Just his love of telling lies or his disinterest in telling the truth. That's what Midvar Sheker Tirchak means. Don't say anything which isn't absolutely accurate. Which isn't absolutely correct. What is the philosophy, or rather what is the psychology of lying? There are different kinds of liars. They're liars who lie for gain. There are all sorts of different kinds of liars. And they're chronic liars too. They're people who just can't tell the truth. What is it in a human being that makes them tell a lie? For that we have to go to the second issue here. The shoychad lo tikach, and you mustn't take bribery, ki ha-shoychad ye'aver pikhim, because bribery blinds the eyes. Pikeach means both a wise man and a man who can see. So let's translate it literally. Shochad, bribery, blinds the vision of a man who can see. Makes you blind. Rav Dessler has a fantastic concept in this connection. And he says the following. He says the human being is endowed with an amazing gift. And that is the ability to disregard anything which is not relevant to your interest. Right? Let me repeat that. A human being is endowed with a special gift to disregard anything, any information, which is not relevant to your interest. You see that, for example, if you're looking through a book because there's a particular thing you're looking for, and you're able to turn pages just as quickly as this, until you see it, because you don't see anything else. And as soon as you'll see the thing that interests you, it will jump up. Nothing else appears. You don't see anything else. That's how it is. If you're looking for something, you're looking for a street name while you're driving, it's quite dangerous because you're not looking at anything else. You don't see anything else. You're looking for the street name, that's all. And as soon as you see the street name, it's the name, it'll hit you. And then somebody will say, what was the name of the street before that? And you didn't even notice. And they say, how couldn't you have noticed? If you were looking for that street, surely you noticed what the other streets were? No, it doesn't go like that. You don't read the name of each street. You're just looking for one thing, and when you see that, you read it. Until you see it, you don't even read it. You don't even see it. You don't see that for which you're not looking. Or more correctly, you don't see that for which, with which you know, or for which you're not really interested. When you read through a newspaper, you don't even see most of it. You only see the things that sort of interest you. If something doesn't interest you, you don't even see it. And if you see it, you don't even remember it at all. It doesn't make any kind of impact at all. And this one's basically interested in it. Says the Rav Dessler, one can have, if two people are coming to court, one can have an academic detached interest in finding the solution to their argument. That's okay. Then I will see everything relevant to finding the solution to their argument. But if my interest is different to finding the solution to the argument, then there are aspects of the case that I won't even see. Because that's the gift of the human being. He's able to totally be blind to things which which he's not interested in seeing. The Gemara in Ksubis, Daf Kuf Hei Amud Beis, 105b, puts it very clearly too. Omar Rava said, "My taima de shuchda. Why is it prohibited to take a gift from a litigant if in any case you plan to find that litigant, you believe that litigant is the one who deserves to merit?" Answers the Rava, "Kivan de kabil le shuchda mine. Once you have received shoychad from him, once you have received bribery from him, ikrava le date, his opinion becomes close to you, legabe. The havi kugufe, it becomes part of you. The ein odom roye choyva liatzmo. And a human being is incapable to see a point against himself." Says the Gemara, says Rava, your interest changes. You're no longer dispassionate and objectively involved in finding the solution to the case. Now you're involved in the individual, in the person. I'll put that a little bit further and say, when we talk about being objective, what do we mean? Normally one thinks that being objective means being dispassionate, looking at it just with one's head without any feelings at all. That's not really correct, because there's nothing to say that a judge, a dayan, when judging people, should be dispassionate, shouldn't be sensitive to the feelings that are going on. That's part of what he's got to judge.
And in fact, there are certain chiyuvim of the judge to use his own intuitive feeling as well. The Mefoshim say in Halacha that when it talks about a judge judging emes la'amitoi, what is true according to his truth, there's a lot of discussion what that means. Who is his truth? Emes, if it's true, it's true. And the Prisho and the Drisho say that emes la'amisoi means emes, it's got to be true, la'amisoi shel dayan. The dayan must feel subjectively also that it's true. In other words, if he cross-examines the witnesses, but he still feels intuitively that somebody's telling a lie here, he doesn't have to accept that evidence. He carries on and on and on until he finds out what's wrong. In other words, it's not just that one looks at it dispassionately according to the laws of evidence, and if it works out that way, you're the one who's chayev, you're the one who's potu. It doesn't work like that at all. The judge has to use his instincts and his intuitions to feel what's going on here. So what does it mean when we talk about a person being objective? What it means is that you're treating the litigants as objects. That's what it means. Not that you become an object, that the litigants are objects. What does that mean? An object doesn't threaten me. That's it. An object I control. And if I control, I do what I want with the object. When I cease to be objective, then I become the object. And the moment somebody gives me something, I'm the object of a relationship. And who's the subject? The giver. And who's the giver? The litigant. Relation, then it's finished. Once I'm the object of a relationship, then what is my interest here? The relationship. It's no longer the case. And this is something very important, because what comes out of here is that one act of chesed, and we'll see how small that act can be in a moment, can create a relationship. A relationship so strong that even Moshe Rabbeinu would not be allowed to judge if I had such a relationship with him. Let's see examples of shochad. Heichi dami shochad dvorim. What's an example of verbal bribery? Kihod Shmuel, there's a case with Shmuel, have a ava mavarta. He was walking across a bridge, and I suppose bridges in those days were quite rickety. So a man came along and gave him a hand to support. So, yeah, I'll help you across. So when they had crossed, Shmuel said to him, what's news with you? He said, I have a case coming up in court. I have to recuse myself. You help me across the bridge, I've got to recuse myself. Incredible. Shmuel! After a man has just helped him across the bridge, there's a relationship there, which makes him possible as a dayan. To explain it a little bit more clearly, what is the difference between fact and fiction? What's the difference between reading a history book or reading a fiction? History books are sometimes just as exciting, just as well written. Wherein lies the difference? Very simply. In fiction, the author is entitled to start with a theme and to subject the facts to the theme. That is, what he wants to convey to you is not facts. What he wants to convey to you is a concept. What he wants to convey to you is a theme, a principle, a story. And he now creates people, and he creates circumstances, and he creates events, and he creates a string of events to serve the function of that theme which he wants to present to you. In a history book, it's the other way around. You start with the facts. The facts can't be altered. This is what happened. Now let's try and figure out what's the theme. What's behind it all? Why did it all happen in that particular style? That's the difference between fact and fiction. When a dayan goes in to judge a case, he's involved in fact. He just wants to know what happened. That's all he wants to know from the edim. What happened? He goes in without any themes, without any ideas. When he's got a relationship with one of the litigants, there's a theme already. The theme is him and me. It's there, it's an underlying current, it's very subtle. But there's already a theme. It's not just, I want the facts. It's, I have a relationship to preserve. And what creates such a relationship so strong that it can endanger the integrity of a Shmuel? Just helping a man across the bridge. That's enough to create a relationship. People often find it difficult to create relationships. What do you do? How do you... So-and-so's unfriendly. He's cold. Can't get on with him. Have you ever tried helping across the bridge? So get him to a bridge, a nice rickety one, and help him across, and it will do wonders. Let's see another example. Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi, have a ragil arise de ave maisile kulmal ishapso, kansa de peri. Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi had a farm. He had an orchard. And of course, a man like Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi wouldn't work in the orchard himself if he could possibly help it. So he had what we call an oris. An oris works in the orchard and takes a percentage of the profits. He's the manager of the orchard. So Rabbi Shmuel doesn't have to worry about the business at all. He sits and he learns and he teaches and he leads the people as Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi did. And the oris, the manager, brings him once a week, he brings him his share of the profits. And every Friday he used to bring him a basket of fruit. Apart from the profits and everything, every Friday before Shabbos, the manager used to bring the balabos a basket of fruit. Yom Echad, one week, Aisilei Behei B'Shabso. He brought the basket of fruit on Thursday. You'll remember we discussed with Yisroel last week, the skill is to notice when something is different and to question it, to find out what it is. Amalei, so Rabbi Shmuel, but Rabbi Yossi said, Maishno Haidna? Why is this day different from all other days? What's going on this week? Amalei Dina Isli, Vamina Gavuchi Aisile Lema. He said, I've got a case tomorrow, or next week, whenever it is, there's a case coming up in your court, in your Beis Din. And I thought, while I'm passing, I would just bring you in a basket of fruit. No harm, it's your fruit, and I bring it tomorrow. In any case, I'm just bringing it today, that's all. Lo Kabil Mine. He said, take it back. I won't take it. Omale, and he said to him, Pasil nalach ledina, after not taking the fruit. He still said, I've got to recuse myself, I can't be your judge. There's no way that I can give you a straight judgment after your having brought me the fruit on Thursday instead of Friday, even though I didn't take it. Oisiv zuzad rabonin v'kadainin le. Two judges, two rabonin, were sitting and judging the manager of Rabbi Yishmael's business. Bahadi deko azil va'ati. Just at the time that Rabbi Yishmael was walking outside the Beis Din. He was walking around there. Omar, so he's a professional and this is his life, Rabbi Yishmael, so obviously he can't help but hear what's going on, so he listens to the case. Omar, he started getting involved. Iboi toin hachi, why doesn't he claim like this now? Viboi toin natalti kach, viboi toin hachi, and if he wants to, he can claim this. And then he can work it out this way. And then if he moves that, and instead he can withdraw that. And Rabbi Yishmael was becoming so excited as to how he could win this case. The audience could win this case. Amar tipach nafsham shel mekablei shoychad. All of a sudden he stopped himself. And he said, the souls of receivers of bribery should rot. Uma ani. What if I? Sheloi notalti. I didn't take anything. Ve'im notalti. Sheli notalti. And if I would have taken, I would have been taking my own. He wasn't giving me anything of his. It was my fruit. And I didn't even take it. Kach mekable shoychat. Halachas kama vekama. Can you imagine how this distorts the reasoning of a judge who actually receives bribery? Shmuel suddenly realized what had happened. Rabbi Shmuel started to realize what would happen. He started talking like a lawyer instead of like a judge. He's starting to work out how he can win the case for this man. Why? Because he did a mitzvah, he offered to bring him the fruit one day earlier. That created an emotional involvement with the man, which Rabbi Yishmael could never ever extricate himself from again. That's the power of a chesed. That's the power of a kindness. One little kindness just to bring him his own fruit one day earlier than you normally do is so powerful that it created a relationship, it created a theme that Rabbi Yishmael was never capable of breaking. And it puzzled him, it caused him to have to recuse himself from the Dayonis, from judging the case of that particular man. Because it's not a question of finding a theme out of the facts. The theme exists before the facts are presented. And that makes it impossible for him to judge in a straight fashion. And if you look at all the dinim of a Dayan in this regard, you'll find that they all revolve around the same principle. that a judge mustn't listen to one person's side before the other one is present. Why? Because then the theme is there before the case has started. You've heard one side, that's created a theme. Because you've only heard the one side. As long as you've got the other man sitting there, and you see him getting cross with every word that the other litigant says, and you see him shaking his head and banging and making notes, okay, there's a picture forming you, there's not a theme. It's a case. You see that there's another side. But when you only hear one man talking, when you only hear the one man talking and the other man isn't present, although he's saying exactly what he would say if the other man would be present, that puzzles you, that denies you the opportunity of sitting in on that case. Because you have a theme before you start. And you're now going to subject the facts to the theme, rather than develop the theme out of the facts. And that's the difference between fact and fiction, and we can't have that in a Beis Din. What's all this got to do with Sheker? A lot. And here we have the whole psychology of a liar. It's very simple. A liar is not prepared, not willing, not able to accept the facts of life and adjust to them. The liar has a theme before he starts, and he wants the facts to support that theme. That's what it is. And if you look at all levels and all areas of lack of integrity, you'll see that this is the underlying principle. What does it mean, for example? Let's take Rabbeinu Yonah's case of what he calls the worst liar, and we would call normally the least of the liars. How many people were at the football? Thousands. Why do you say thousands if there were only a few hundred? Because you're not prepared to accept that other people are going to know that there were only a few hundreds, for whatever reason. You don't want other people to have the picture of you being one of 500 people among tens of thousands of empty seats. That picture you don't want people to have. You just want the picture of being one of the lucky ones who got in. So you're not prepared to accept reality and adjust and say, now why did I go and nobody else went? Was it badly advertised, or was it a rotten game to start with? Was I the stupid idiot, or was everybody else the stupid idiot? Instead of finding fulfillment out of analyzing the facts and trying to draw a theme out of the facts, what happened here? I've got to start with that I'm not the idiot. I'm right. If I'm right, why were there 10,000 empty seats there? Well, the first thing is to cover that up. Nobody must know that there were 10,000 empty seats. So how many people were there? It was packed. It wasn't packed. That's how it is. It might be easier to understand that example if a concert pianist or a violinist or whatever it is comes home from the concert and his family say to him, "No, how did it go? It's wonderful. Were there a lot of people there?" Yeah, the place was packed. I mean, that's an obvious, it wasn't packed. What's he got to gain out of saying it was packed? Nothing. What's he causing anybody else a loss by saying that it was packed? Nothing. Just pride. So he's not prepared to accept the facts and come home and say to his wife, "You know, I must be a rotten violinist. There was nobody there. Or this thing wasn't advertised properly. Or is Dallas on tonight? What's happening? Nobody was there tonight." He's not prepared to take the facts and try and delve to understand what went wrong, what happened. No, he starts with his theme. Wherever I go, the place is packed. And he really becomes to believe that. A liar believes his own lies eventually. He forgets that it was empty. He begins to convince himself too, and when somebody will ask him in 2 weeks' time, were there a lot of people there, he'll answer like that, it was packed, and he'll see in his mind all the people that were there, and they weren't there. That's a person who has his theme, who has his... He's created his metzias, he's created his reality, even before he's there. In cases of financial gain, as far as lying is concerned, it's the same thing. The theme is, I want the 100 rand. The lie is to create such facts which will give me the 100 rand. This applies also in learning very much. That's why learning is a wonderful exercise for intellectual integrity. Because in exactly the same way, if you approach a sugya, if you approach a piece of learning with a preconceived idea, you can be guaranteed that the principle of Rav Dessler will apply. You won't see anything in that isn't relevant to your preconceived idea. And one of the hardest things in learning is to be able to learn with an open mind. To be able to open up and say, what is he saying? Not what I'm saying. What is he saying? What does he mean? and to work out what it is that the Chumash is saying, or the Gemara is saying, or Rashi is saying, or Tosfos is saying, or the Medrash is saying, not to try and find the proof for my idea. To start learning with the idea that I've got a Chiddush, I've got something that I want to say, can I find it somewhere in the Sedra? You'll find what it suits you to find. You're looking for something specific. You'll find that thing that's specific possibly, but you won't find things that don't bear directly on that. Sometimes one reads a book because one wants to know what the book says. Sometimes one's working on an idea, on a theme, and one wants to see what's been written about this before, what do people say about it. You have an idea, there's nothing wrong with that, you can do it. But then you haven't read the book, and you don't understand what the book is really saying. All you've done is you've paged through it to see whether there's anything in the book which supports your theories or otherwise. That's all it is.
And the Yalkut points out that the words, the letters of the words Sheker and Emet are very interesting.
Sheker, firstly, are the last three letters of the alphabet, whereas Emet, second last three letters of the alphabet. Whereas Emet, it can't be the last three because Taf belongs to Emet. Whereas Emet is the first, the last, and the middle. Aleph from the beginning, Taf from the end, Mem from the middle. The second thing is that Sheker, the letters all stand on one leg. The shin, all the sticks come together at one point. The kuf stands.
Because
there are many ways of understanding that Yalkut, but just in the light of what we've done, firstly, Sheker standing on one leg. I just want one thing out of it. I'm not trying to see all the aspects of what it says. I'm reading a Pasuk, I'm reading a Rashi. I just want to know one point out of it. Does it support it or does it go against it? Which is the one that I'm connected to? So then they must be synchronized. Whereas an emes stands on both legs. I want to know everything that it says. I want to know the whole thing. I want to know all about it. Sheker, the last three letters. I don't want to know the build-up. I just want to know the untista. Well, what's the end of the story? Don't tell me how Aleph leads to Beis, and Beis leads to Gimel, and Gimel leads to Dalet. Don't start learning Gemara with me, and Mishnah, and Chumash, and going through the whole sugya, and working out the Mishnah, and the Deus, and the this, and the that. Just tell me the end. Well, what's the din? What does the Torah say about such and such? That's Sheker. When you try that, you're going to get dishonesty, you're going to get inaccuracy. MS is when you look at the thing from beginning to the end with everything in the middle, and your mind is open to find everything you can in it, and you're not approaching it with a preconceived idea that all I want to know about it is ABCD. I want to know everything that it has to tell me. Then you're on to MS, then you're on to truth, not on to Sheker. One finds that in learning that one has to be careful not to approach it with a preconceived idea, not to try and prove anything out of your learning, but to go to your learning and open it up and see, what has the Gemara got to tell us today? What can we learn out of it? And to be sure that at all times one's extracting the theme from the facts and not bending the facts to create the theme. The only time you're allowed to bend the facts to create a theme is in a sermon. And the sermon is a bit like fiction. It's the same kind of art form. It's a drosha. There one can... one can do it within certain limits. It has to be very carefully done, but there one can do it. That's when I talk about the difference between a shir and a drosha. That's it. A shir has to be the facts developing into a theme. A drosha, you start with a theme and you bring facts to illustrate the theme. The three Gemaras that I brought on are quite clear. The one where it's a question of losing money, he offers 1,000 rand and later on he offers 10,000 rand and I take the 1,000 rand. It's no shaila, what's it there? But his whole involvement is his excitement in life. Let's put it this way. People get different kicks out of life. Some people's kicks are when they project facts that make them look good. And some people's kicks are just by enjoying the facts, just by being involved in real life. That's it. Some people enjoy that. That's reality. They take life as it comes. This is the reality of it. And they don't waste their time trying to change life or trying to change the impression and the projection of life on others. That's what it is. These are the facts. Now let's get busy working with reality. And some people are so wrapped up in themselves that their kicks come out of ensuring that the way they are seen is always in the best of light. And those people really generally don't enjoy life at all. But that's what they seem to get their kicks out of. Whereas the man who really has a healthy nachas and enjoyment from life is the man who says, right, what happens, that I must accept. There's no way I can change facts. These are the facts. I must just have the facts clear. I must know what's going on. Once I know what's going on, I can deal with it. That's the one kind of man. So a man comes along to somebody like Rav Safra. He says, look, the reality is I'm very happy to sell it for 1,000 rand. So I can tell you that in my heart I didn't want to sell it for 1,000 rand. 10,000 rand is my price. But I'm distorting reality. I get my kicks out of life out of doing what's real, not doing what's fake. And what's real is to sell it for 1,000 rand. So that's bad business. Well, I get my kicks out of turning that into good business somehow or other. I'll have to sort it out. That's Rav Safra. And so it is with the son, Rav Chiya bar Rav, who changed his father's words, and his father said, don't do it. Don't change reality, says the father. I'll sort out your mother. Don't worry, that's what I get my kicks out of. I get my kicks out of fixing up the marriage honestly. Not by hiding, not by lack of communication, not by telling lies and hiding things from her and her hiding things from me. So it'll be unpleasant for a few weeks, there'll be conflict for a few weeks. Leave it to me, I'll sort it out. Don't you tell lies to cover me up. That's, I don't get any joy out of that. I like to take the facts as they are. The fact is, I've got a crazy wife. I'm going to fix her. She's going to be not a crazy wife by the time I'm finished with her, and our marriage is going to be happy. That's what I get pleasure from. And so also in the case of the man who said that his wife wasn't there when his wife really was there. By the way, I don't think that there would be anything wrong if you simply said, my wife is unavailable. In other words, I don't think he's being criticized for not having said, my wife's washing her hair. I think he's right. He should never have said his wife was washing her hair, but he didn't have to say she was out. He could say it some other way. If one does have to tell, be inaccurate in one's speech, the inaccuracy should be as little as possible. And Rav Nosson Shiller told me in the name of the Ikrim, that the Ikrim says that in nature, you find that the most common form is a circle. The trunk of a tree is circular, a rainbow is a semicircle, flowers are circular, everything's circular. The one exception to that is a bee's hive where the cells are hexagonal. And the Alba asks, why? Why are they hexagonal and not circular? So he answers very obviously, so that they shouldn't waste space. If they would be circular, there would be space in between. Asks the Alba, in that case, they should be square. Why hexagonal? Answers the Alba, if you have to deviate from something which is normal, deviate as little as possible. A square is too far from a circle if you can get away with a hexagon. A hexagon is a cross between a square and a circle. And if you can manage by just moving a little bit away, don't move too far away. If you have to be a little bit inaccurate, if you can't tell the blatant truth, my wife is washing her hair, that's not derech eretz, it's none of her business what my wife is doing. So you can't say, my wife is washing her hair. Say, she's unavailable at the moment. Can you come back in half an hour later? She's just busy right now. Can she come back to you? There are all sorts of things one can say. But don't tell a lie. To say she's out when she's in, that's a lie. And we're not allowed to do that. And the fun of living is to manage to retain a sense of derech eretz, to manage to retain the refinements of interpersonal relationship without having to tell lies. To have to hide behind the lie, that's not good. If somebody says to you, please phone me tomorrow, and you don't, to say the next day that you didn't tell me, I don't remember you telling me to phone you, that's not living. Living is to say, you know, you're right, you told me to phone you, but I'm sorry, I had more important things to do. Or I'm sorry, I clean forgot. Please accept my apologies. That's real living. When we hide behind dishonesties, even the accepted little polite dishonesties, it's not living. It's building huge facades between people. Facades which can never be broken down, and communication can never penetrate through those facades. And it's the action of panic-stricken little people who are scared of their own shadows, who are not able to handle the day-to-day normal events of life. They're scared of people, scared of friends, scared of associates. There's no reason to be scared. Life is to take the facts, confront them, and deal with them. And if dealing with them means backing down, you back down. If dealing with them means fighting over them, you fight over them. But you don't run away behind a lie, even if it's a subtle, tiny little lie which nobody would mind. We mind. It's not allowed according to the Torah. To use a lie to hide behind is not allowed. There's one other aspect of Dvar Sheker, and there are many other aspects which we'll still talk about, hopefully. But the one that I wanted to talk to about, particularly very briefly, is halachic realities. To say that it's daytime outside when it's nighttime, that's a lie. We aren't allowed to say such a thing. Even if everybody knows it's a lie, you're not allowed to say such a thing. To say she's not at home when she is at home, that's a lie. To say I didn't want to sell it for 1,000 rand when I did want to sell it for 1,000 rand, that's a lie. In other words, lying or truth means that one's words and one's actions have to be tied to reality. Emotional reality, that there must be no gap between what I feel and what I say. The reality outside, there must be, in other words, if I'm reporting my feelings, I must report them accurately. If I'm reporting an event or a phenomenon or a fact, I must report it accurately. Comes the question, and this leads into next week's shiur already, of halachic facts and reality. Sheker, to do something which is not in accordance with the facts, is also sheker. Not just to say something, but to do something which is not in accordance with the facts. What I'm becoming very disturbed about with people who've joined the Beis HaMedrash in recent years, or in more recent years, is the tendency of people to take major decisions on matters of career, serious dating, marriage, studying, all sorts of plans, without consulting halacha. It's something which I just can't understand. There's a halacha, there's a clarity in the Torah of what's right and what's wrong. And that clarity is a human clarity. It's not just a list of things that here you can just check up and say this is what it is for everybody. There are certain principles, there are ways of analyzing the rightness and the wrongness of anything, of any situation. Obviously one can't come running on every minor little thing. One has to try and figure it out oneself. And as one progresses in Torah, so one's ability to figure out what's right and what's wrong increases all the time. And that's really the purpose of a Motzei Shabbos here like this, is to try and use some of the principles which we learn in the Torah to analyze the normal things that confront a human being during his lifetime and figure out the rightness and wrongness of them. But when it comes to major decisions, you know, and it's too late to come and question the rightness of the wrongness of a particular shidduch once one's on the verge of getting engaged. What are you going to do then? That's no time to ask. The time to ask is after one has been out twice. You've met the other party twice, now it's a question. I mean, if you're not just going out socially, but you're going out with the intention of finding a match. At that point, one has to ask already. Because an involvement beyond that already becomes to an extent an inextricable involvement. You know, this principle of Rav Dessler is incredible. The principle that once you're interested in something, you become blind to everything which is not in accordance with that interest. Rav Dessler says very beautiful. He says the only people who you find looking up in Shulchan Aruch to see whether you can play chess on Shabbos are people who want to play chess. And you know, nobody comes home from Shul and Shabbos and says, what should we learn today? Let's have a look if you can play chess to Shabbos. That's not the kind of thing one learns. One hasn't got time for that. So the only time that you'll find somebody with a Shulchan Aruch open on the chess page is somebody who's dying to play chess and he's trying to find a heter. That's what he's doing. And he's disqualified. Once you're looking at halacha with an interest, it's going to blind you to some of the other facts which you're not going to be able to see. And if that's the case, how much is it so with all our major decisions? If we approach them before we're interested at all, okay, one can still work them out a little bit. But once one's involved oneself, and one has a basic attitude and a basic interest, I would like to do medicine. That's where it starts from. Now, can I find anything wrong with it? Is there any reason why I shouldn't do medicine? No, nothing wrong. So I'll do medicine. That's the way most people make their decisions. I would like to go in Aliyah. Really, it's time. I have a burning desire to go in Aliyah. Let's think, is there anything that could possibly be wrong with it? Aliyah, big mitzvah. It's one of the biggest mitzvahs in the Torah. It is. Any reason? All sorts of new mitzvahs I get out of going on Aliyah. Meisah, Truma, Shmita. Fantastic. The communities I could live among. Everything's fantastic. Let's go. That's how one makes the day-to-day decisions of one's life start from a desire, because you don't look up on the chess page in the Shulchan Aruch unless you want to play chess. So you don't start thinking, should I, shouldn't I, unless you've decided already that you want to. Not that you will, but that you want to. And once you want to, you're disqualified. There's no way that you can see the thing now as a dayan. If Shmuel and Rabbi Yishmael wouldn't judge a matter just because they now had some kind of interest. What interest? The man brought the fruit on Thursday instead of Friday, his own fruit. Helped him across the bridge. That's the kind of interest that he had. That was the kind of relationship. But that's enough already to disqualify him from seeing certain aspects of the judgment, certain aspects of the case. How can one go into major decisions of one's life without checking up what the halacha is? Unless one's saying, and this is usually the case, it starts with what I want. Nobody deliberately goes against the halacha. I'm talking about people who are involved in Yiddishkeit and people who are involved in learning. Nobody deliberately goes against halacha. So what is it? It's a decision to do something, a reference to halacha in one's own little mind to check whether there's anything wrong with it, and obviously one's going to find nothing wrong with it, and then a procedure in merry abandon. And it's something which is incredibly dangerous. And what's brought me to this is that I've been watching these cases quietly, one by one, and I blame myself possibly for it, because perhaps when we were smaller and when we started off, the communication was such that these things just didn't happen. But I sort of watched it going, okay, it's done already, what can I do? All of a sudden, another one, done. Okay, another one, done. Start getting involved a little bit. Did you check up with anybody? Have you thought about it? Yes, thought about it, spoken to a few people and done. Did you think about this? Not really. Did you think about this? No. Did you think about that? Well, I thought about it, but it doesn't seem to be very important. Why not? When I see that the wishy-washiness on which these decisions are based, and even then I would have kept quiet and wouldn't have talked about it publicly. But subsequently I've seen the failures of many of these decisions. And then I stopped feeling very responsible and very upset that people can take such decisions just so lightly and fall into the most obvious pitfalls. Obvious to an outsider, but not obvious once you've decided that's what you want to do. Then one gets very worried about the method of approach. Most decisions, we have to remember, most decisions start with a desire. I want to do it. Now, is it the right thing to do? Once you want to do it, you are no longer qualified to say whether it's the right thing to do. The only time you can say whether it's the right thing to do is if you're involved in fact, not in fiction. Fiction starts with the theme and everything builds around the theme. When you want something, you have your theme already. And all your learning and all your research and all your questioning around that theme is all to serve the theme. And you're not going to notice things which aren't in the interest of the theme. The only time that one's qualified to go into an issue is if one's desires are just to find out the emes, just to find out the truth. How does one reach there? Because the din is that a rov can paskin for himself. You can't judge a case, a monetary case, you can't judge for somebody else if you're interested in that person, if you've received bribery. But a rov can paskin his own shilas. How does he paskin his own shilas? He has to get to the state, and everybody has to get to the stage where they're busy with facts and not with fictions. Where their thrill of life is to know what really is and to fit into the reality. Most psychological problems, most complexes and most difficulties are people who are just not prepared to accept this is what has happened. That's it. Now let's move from here. These are the facts, or this is what's going to happen. That's it. It's going to happen. Now how are you going to handle it? Most of the psychological problems of people who are still trying to change the facts and can't settle with the facts. If one is able to reach the stage where one accepts that these are the facts, this is real now. My thrill is to cope with them. My thrill, the thrill of feeling alive, is to deal with these facts in a constructive way. Somehow I've got to make them productive. Somehow I've got to use them positively. That's what the thrill of life is. And when one's got that attitude with one's own life, then it doesn't matter. Then your research comes before your desires. Then a shaila is brought to your notice by yourself. not by a desire. Or let's say yes, by a desire, but a desire to know what are the facts, what is the truth, what is correct. And that's the only way that one can approach a problem and that one can analyze it. And the method of that is a subservience to halacha. That's it, an understanding. Once one has, I'm not talking about people who are just beginning to get involved in Yiddishkeit at this stage. Obviously, their experience of halacha is too limited to have the kind of confidence we're talking about. But I'm talking about people who are involved, who understand, who know what Torah is, who know what Yiddishkeit is, who know what halacha is. The first thing is an understanding. Once I know that is the din, I do it. Finished. Now the next thing is just to find out what the din is. To find out the halacha, that's all. Some things are easy, one can look up oneself. Some things one has to learn through with somebody else. Some things one has to ask a shayla. But there's not a single aspect, as you well know, of life which isn't covered by halacha. The way we walk, the way we dress, the way we talk, the way we work, the way we learn, the way we relate to one another, the way we relate to our wives, to our children, to our parents. Every single step, there's an emes and a sheker. There's a true way of doing it and there's a false way of doing it. There's a way of doing it which is based on an understanding of the facts of the relationships. What is clothing? What is tznius? What are human beings? What are situations? And how do they all function together? What is a husband? What is a wife? How do they interrelate under such and such a circumstance? That's emes. And sheker is doing it the way you want to do it. And then trying to make the halacha fit into that. Or trying to find that the halacha fits into it. That's how I feel comfortable. That's how I like it. That's how all my friends do it. That's how I want to do it. Now, is it really so serious? I mean, surely there are more serious things than that. Of course one can think that way. One can think that way with anything. I don't want to keep Shabbos. How serious is Shabbos really? Surely Lashon Hara is more serious than Shabbos? Sure, Lashon Hara is more serious than Shabbos. Shabbos is still pretty serious. Or the other way around. Lashon Hara, I can't help myself from talking Lashon Hara. Shabbos, I keep. How important is Lashon Hara? Everybody talks Lashon Hara. Once you've decided that you want to talk, you'll find that it's not that serious to do it. Once you've decided that you don't want to keep Shabbos, it's not that serious to keep Shabbos. When the thing starts with a rotzen, when it starts with a desire to play the game of chess, you won't find those parts of the Shulchan Aruch that say there's a problem with chess on Shabbos, if there's a problem with chess on Shabbos. You won't see them. You'll just be completely blind to them. The same as when you're paging through the book looking for a particular item, you just don't see anything which is not connected with that, which is not relevant to that. And that's the thing that we have to be so careful of. Whenever we have a situation where the problem is brought to our notice by a desire, by a will, by a want, that's the point we have to ask a shayla. Because at that point we're incapable of deciding ourselves. If it's something very small and irrelevant, okay, so you try and figure it out as best you can, but usually these things are not so small and irrelevant. Usually they're things which can affect the rest of one's life. One has to sit down and work out what is emes and what is sheker. What are the facts? What are the principles behind those facts? And how do I relate to those facts? And that has to be preceded by a willingness. Once halacha has been clarified, once one knows what the halacha is, once one knows what the emes is, it has to be preceded by a willingness and an undertaking to follow that halacha, to put it into practice, and to live by it.